Independent counsel Kenneth Starr has charged former Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell and Mr. Hubbell's wife and their tax preparers with conspiring to avoid paying $500,000 in taxes, plus several hundred thousand dollars more in interest and penalties. Last year, Webb Hubbell was released from prison after serving 18 months for defrauding his former law partners, including First Lady Hillary Clinton, of nearly $400,000. Mr. Hubbell pleaded guilty to those charges, also brought by Mr. Starr, but this time he proclaims his innocence and accuses the independent counsel of trying to coerce him into lying about the Clintons. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
When Hubbell pled guilty in 1994, he promised to cooperate with prosecutors, but he never delivered any incriminating information against the Clintons and has said repeatedly that he doesn't have any. Prosecutor Starr, however, believes otherwise. That belief is buttressed by the hundreds of thousands of dollars in consulting fees obtained by Hubbell after he left the Justice Department, consulting arrangements that several top Clinton aides have acknowledged they helped arrange. White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles, former Chief of Staff Mac McClarty, Clinton lawyer and confidant Mickey Cantor, and presidential confidant Vernon Jordan have all told the grand jury that they tried to help Hubbell because he was a friend in desperate financial trouble. But independent counsel Starr suspected that the consulting arrangements were nothing more than hush money and that Hubbell held the key that could crack the Clinton case. Unable to prove those suspicions, however, Starr has now lowered the boom on Hubbell again, hoping to break him. Yesterday, a federal grand jury in Washington indicted Hubbell, his wife, and the lawyer and accountant who helped him prepare his taxes on charges of conspiracy, tax evasion, and mail fraud. Charles Bacalli, the spokesman for the independent counsel, announced the indictment.
The tax and mail fraud violations alleged in the indictment charge that the Hubbells owed taxes, interest, and penalties to the IRS, the state of Arkansas, and the District of Columbia in excess of $894,000. The indictment alleges that in or about April of 1994, Webster Hubbell began a consulting business and received hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees. The indictment further alleges that he performed little or no work for some of these payments.
Last night, a red-eyed and defiant Hubbell appeared outside his home with his wife at his side.
I want you to know that the Office of Independent Counsel can indict my dog. They can indict my cat, but I'm not going to lie about the president. I'm not going to lie about the first lady or anyone else.
Most legal experts who looked at the indictment yesterday called it excessive, but noted that prosecutors trying to break what they believe is a cover-up often engage in such tactics. Tax experts said that most of the charges against the Hubbells involving their failure to pay taxes are rarely, if ever, brought. Sheldon Cohen served as general counsel and commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service in the Johnson administration.
The failure to pay a tax currently when I've got a few bucks in the bank and my family is worried about surviving is not at all unusual, and I have never seen a criminal case brought on that basis.
Cohen noted that what tax lawyers routinely advise clients to do is to file and not to conceal income.
The standard advice that a tax lawyer gives is, for God's sakes, if you are hard up for money, file a return even if you can't pay the tax.
After reviewing the indictment, Cohen said that under ordinary circumstances, most of the charges would usually be resolved with civil penalties, but that the most serious charges are that the Hubbells, with the help of their tax preparers, set up trusts for their children's education, for living expenses, and another bank account, and did not reveal those assets to the Internal Revenue Service.
Assuming they can make those factual statements and, you know, prove them out in court, that's a no-no. I mean, you don't lie.
But Hubbell's defense is expected to contend that at the time Hubbell and his wife were reporting to the IRS collection agency, those accounts had only a few hundred dollars in them, not the tens of thousands of dollars they later contained. Hubbell's defenders concede that the Hubbell family of six spent money they should not have. From 1994 to 97, $85,000 on clothes and $5,000 on beauty parlor appointments, for example. But as one friend put it, the Hubbells got in trouble to begin with by living beyond their means, and they were like a racehorse at the finish line. It took a while for them to slow down to a walk. All of this and more will be laid out at the trial that now seems inevitable. But in the meantime, the battle for public opinion continues. Late last night, House Republicans released selected portions of tape recordings made of phone conversations Hubbell had with his wife while he was in prison. The Hubbells knew that the conversations were monitored as they discussed whether he might sue his former law partners. But some of the comments could be interpreted as Mrs. Hubbell worrying that she would lose her federal job if Hubbell did anything to harm Mrs. Clinton.
I won't erase those allegations that might open it up to Hillary. And you know that. We talked about it.
Yes. But then I get all this back from Marcia, who's ratcheting it up and making it sound like, you know, if Webb goes ahead and sues the firm back, then any support I have at the White House is gone. I mean, that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing the squeeze play.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate has overwhelmingly approved the first post-Cold War expansion of NATO. President Clinton praised last night's vote to add Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic to the military alliance. The U.S. is the sixth NATO member to approve the expansion. All 19 members must ratify the agreement. As NPR's Peter Kinnon reports, many of the 19 senators who voted against expansion were worried about its economic and political costs.
This realignment in the political geography of Europe is seen by some as a positive step and by others as a potentially dangerous one. In the U.S. Senate, the former view won out decisively. Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry spoke for many when he said it's not clear how large NATO could or should eventually become.
The bottom line is, however, that this expansion of NATO at this point in time, under these circumstances, will make NATO stronger and will also protect, enhance, and serve the interests of the United States of America.
Questions about the expansion were posed eloquently and at length, but only one amendment that could have caused problems for the treaty even came close to passing, a proposal by Virginia Republican John Warner to impose a 3-year waiting period after this expansion before any new countries could be invited to join NATO. Warner is worried about the fact that there's no clear mission for an expanded NATO and no clear cost estimate either. He hit close to home with some lawmakers when he pointed out that this expansion would require new military bases to be built in Eastern Europe at a time when the Pentagon is calling for a new round of base closures at home.
And you will be fairly asked by your constituents. You mean to tell me they're closing our beloved hometown base that has been here defending America all these years, and you are helping to build bases abroad?
But the Senate rejected the waiting period, and other amendments were either defeated or watered down into non-binding statements of intent. Even concerns about threatening Russia and perhaps reigniting the Cold War failed to muster much opposition to the expansion. Support for adding these three nations to NATO was most passionate among those with vivid memories of the war that swept across Europe 50 years ago, and the failure of the West after the war to defend them. Maryland Democrat Barbara Mikulski, a Polish-American well-versed in the history of Poland, said she only wished her great-grandmother could be there to see this response, 5 decades later, to the conferences at Potsdam and Yalta that led to Poland's imprisonment behind the Iron Curtain.
My great-grandmother had on her mantle 3 pictures, one of Pius XII, one of my uncle would become a member of the police force, and the other of Roosevelt because she believed in the Democratic Party. After Potsdam and Yalta, she took the picture of Roosevelt and turned him face down until the day she died. This is a historic moment when 3 countries whose heart, soul, and political orientation is with us. So I hope that for those who worked so long and so hard within Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, we then understand the ratification of NATO.
Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Congress has passed and sent to President Clinton an emergency spending bill. Included in the measure is disaster relief for El Nino-related storm damage and money to pay for the deployment of U.S. troops in Bosnia and the Persian Gulf. Aides say the president's going to sign this measure. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The White House had wanted this emergency spending bill not only to pay for troops and disaster relief, but to fund 2 of its priorities, the nearly $1 billion in back dues the U.S. owes the United Nations, and $18 billion to replenish the International Monetary Fund, which has spent money to prop up economies in Asia. At his news conference yesterday, the president repeated his request.
I call on Congress to step up to its responsibility and renew our commitment to the International Monetary Fund and to pay our United Nations dues. I am confident we can do this in a bipartisan fashion.
But bipartisanship is a scarce commodity in Washington these days. Republicans in the House think the IMF may do as much harm as good, and the issue has also become tangled up in a dispute over abortion. Democrats were upset that in order to pay for the disaster relief, Republicans insisted on cuts in other programs, including housing aid and airport projects. Wisconsin Democrat David Obey said Republicans were playing politics with the measure.
I regret that we seem to be regressing into an election year, anything goes mode. That may suit the needs of some people in this body. It does not suit the needs of the people who sent us here.
But Republicans argued that it was the White House that was playing politics by threatening a veto and that time was running out. The Defense Department had warned it might have to start furloughing civilian workers if it didn't get the funds it needed. Florida Republican Bill Young said resources for troops in the U.S. were being depleted.
While the deployed forces were working hard to keep them ready and keep them well equipped, the non-deployed forces back home are running out of equipment, running out of training money.
So the White House backed off its veto threat, postponing the fights over the UN and the IMF for another day. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Black Power activist Eldridge Cleaver died today at a hospital near Los Angeles. He was 62. Cleaver first gained fame with his book Soul on Ice, written while he was in prison on narcotics and assault charges. He was a founding member of the Black Panther Party in 1966 and was known for his violent rhetoric as its information minister. After a shootout with police, he fled the country and remained abroad for 7 years. After his return in 1975, Cleaver renounced the Black Panthers, becoming a born-again Christian and a Republican. He'd recently been working as a diversity consultant at a university near Los Angeles. In a speech before the San Antonio Bar Association today, independent counsel Kenneth Starr drew comparisons between his current situation and that of Watergate prosecutors over the issue of executive privilege. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
Starr refused to comment directly on his grand jury investigation of President Clinton. Still, he managed to convey his views through historical anecdotes and quotes. He pointed out that 24 years this day, President Nixon invoked executive privilege to quash the subpoenas of Watergate prosecutors. Starr said the U.S. Supreme Court ruled then that the president's claim to secrecy is strong for military or diplomatic secrets, but evidence relevant to a criminal investigation or prosecution must be turned over. Starr quoted Watergate prosecutors Leon Jaworski that no one, absolutely no one, is above the law. White House officials said Starr is engaged in a PR battle and that his legal views are incomplete and, quote, frozen in time. A federal judge in Washington could rule any day now on President Clinton's claim of privilege on behalf of senior White House aides in the Lewinsky matter. Chitra Raghavan, NPR News, Washington.
An Interior Ministry spokesman says Russian President Boris Yeltsin's representative to the breakaway Republic of Chechnya has been kidnapped. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Moscow.
Details remain sketchy, but reports say Valentin Vlasov, President Yeltsin's personal envoy to Chechnya, was abducted at gunpoint from his car on a road near Chechnya's border with Ingushetia. So far, there's no official word as to whether the kidnappers are demanding a ransom or are making political demands. Vlasov has been a key behind-the-scenes figure in negotiations between Russia and Chechnya since the end of their war nearly 2 years ago. Kidnapping for ransom has become epidemic in Chechnya, with hundreds of people, including some foreigners, still being held. The government of Chechen President Aslan Maskhadov has vowed to fight the problem, but so far with little success. The news agency TASS reports that Yeltsin has ordered a top-level task force to coordinate efforts to free Vlasov. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Moscow.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 84 points to end the day at 9,147. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. An Avis car rental franchise in North Carolina has agreed to pay more than $2 million to settle a class action discrimination suit. Black customers claimed they were denied car rentals at five locations in North Carolina and South Carolina. Former employees said the franchise owner instructed his staff to avoid renting to black customers by asking them for proof of employment and requiring higher credit card limits. Last year, the National Avis Corporation agreed to pay more than $3 million to settle claims that it failed to stop the discrimination, but that didn't affect customers' claims against the franchises. Some in Guatemala are concerned that the wrong man may have been arrested yesterday for the killing of a Roman Catholic bishop. Bishop Juan Jose Herardi was killed on Sunday, just after presenting a human rights report on Guatemala's 36-year civil war. NPR's Philip Davis is in Guatemala City.
A doctor from an organization called Physicians for Human Rights had a chance to talk to the suspect yesterday. And there are growing doubts here among that organization and Catholic human rights organizations here that the suspect really could have committed the murder. The suspect is a young, sort of homeless street person with a slight deformity in one of his arms, which they say would make it rather difficult for him to have picked up the 8-pound chunk of concrete that apparently was used to bludgeon the bishop to death.
NPR's Philip Davis. Consumer spending grew in March, even though personal incomes grew at their slowest pace in 8 months. The Commerce Department said consumer spending rose 0.5%. This is NPR News.